From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. President Biden spoke this morning with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They met by video call as tensions mount. Russia has sent tens of thousands of troops to the border with Ukraine. Into Washington, this is a threat to a democratic ally. With us now is Michelle Kellerman, NPR diplomatic correspondent. And Michelle, do we know about what they discussed? Do we know anything yet?
Well, we know that they talked for about 2 hours. Russian television showed Putin sitting at kind of a long conference table at his residence in Sochi and speaking to Biden, who was on this large television screen, waving and saying that he hopes to meet again in person. There was a lot to discuss, obviously, starting with that Russian military buildup along the border with Ukraine. But there are a lot of other issues, too, that the White House said was on the agenda, cybersecurity, Iran's nuclear program. There's just always a lot on the plate when you're dealing with Russia.
Yeah. Well, with these Russian troops amassed at the border, how has Putin explained this and the Kremlin's intentions toward Ukraine?
So he says it's in response to NATO moving assets closer to its borders. He says Western countries are exacerbating the situation in Ukraine by supplying it with weapons and conducting military exercises. Of course, Scott, it was Russia that annexed Crimea in 2014 and sent troops into eastern Ukraine to support separatist movements there. And Russia still backs those puppet governments in eastern Ukraine in regions that are demanding more autonomy. And most experts think that Russia's main goal here is to make sure that Ukraine never becomes part of NATO, the Western alliance. But the U.S. isn't making any promises about that. It says that it won't accept red lines from Russia.
Speaking of the U.S. government, what levers does it have here?
Well, I mean, what Biden talks about is he keeps talking about diplomatic off-ramps. The levers, of course, are more sanctions and pressure, but the diplomatic off-ramps include implementing what's known as the Minsk agreements. These were agreements that were negotiated back in 2014 and 2015 between Ukraine and Russian-backed separatists. There are a lot of political and military steps that have not been implemented. The Russians blame Ukraine for not following through on the kind of steps that are required to give those regions more autonomy. The U.S. and Ukraine blame Russia for not pulling out of Ukrainian territory and ensuring Ukraine's territorial integrity. The problem, though, Russia wasn't a signatory of those deals. So that's kind of the way that Biden is trying to deal with this, is to go back to those agreements and to get Russia to do its part.
Yeah, and very quickly, any suggestion the White House would put American boots on the ground over this situation?
It seems they're really focused on financial issues. I mean, the most dramatic option would be kicking Russia out of the SWIFT, this financial network that connects banks and countries around the world. That's kind of the nuclear option. But it doesn't look like the U.S. or Europe really want to do this. I think what you can expect is just a lot more other kinds of financial pressure.
Michelle Kellerman is NPR diplomatic correspondent. Michelle, thank you as always.
Thank you.
To help put this into context, we're joined by Serhiy Plokhiy, a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University and author of Nuclear Folly, a history of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure.
Professor, the last time Russia made a major move into Ukraine was when it annexed Crimea in 2014. Do you think Putin is preparing to invade, and is Ukraine prepared to fight back?
Yes, Ukraine is prepared to do that, and is prepared much better than it was back in 2014 at the time of the annexation of the Crimea. Ukraine really has now an army that was tested in battle, and has a really mobilized part of the population who volunteered already in 2014, 2015, trying to supply the Ukrainian army with almost everything, because the country, the army were not prepared at all for that invasion. So Ukraine will fight, and Ukraine is prepared actually to fight today more than it was in 2014.
So it's much harder, though, to answer whether Putin is preparing to invade. But more economic sanctions and an increased U.S. military presence in Ukraine could be very costly for Russia. I mean, is Putin really planning to invade, or is this more of a power play for influence?
Certainly, Putin tries by building up those tensions, by moving troops to the Ukrainian border. He tries to really improve his negotiation position with the West and with the United States in particular. But it doesn't mean that this is just or only a diplomatic tool, because we know that Putin is capable of using so-called military option. He did that in Georgia in 2008. He did that in the Crimea in 2014, and then with the hybrid war in eastern Ukraine that continues. So the chances of him invading and using the military force are very and very real. Whether he will do that or not will depend on his calculation of what would be the price that we would have to pay for that. The sanctions that are already there, they caused a lot of hardship for the Russian economy. And the big question is actually, what would be the response of the United States? What would be the response of Europe and Western countries to invasion if it really happens?
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has recently stepped up the call for Ukraine to be included in NATO. How much does Ukraine rely on the U.S. and other Western allies for support against Russia?
The ability that Ukraine has to fight that war, it would be impossible without the support of the West, the United States, the NATO countries to fight effectively. And in that sense, it's very difficult to overestimate the importance that the Western support plays in this ability for Ukraine to stay, continue to stay as an independent state and as an independent country, despite those territorial losses back in 2014. So Western assistance, Western support are absolutely essential.
Right. And what you're saying here really shows that Russia sees NATO as an aggressor.
Russia sees NATO as an aggressor. That's the official certain rhetoric. In more practical terms, Russia uses NATO as an excuse to do things that they want to do, for example, annex the Crimea, despite the fact that Ukrainian membership at that point in NATO was pretty much off the table. So it was used as an excuse. And what really that means is that NATO is an obstacle for Kremlin to establish this sphere of influence. Ukraine is not certainly a threat to Russia in any way, but it's Russia that invades Ukraine and occupies Ukrainian territory. But the accusations are made toward either Ukraine or NATO that tries to support the fight of Ukrainians for their independence. The independence was declared 30 years ago, back in December of 1991. It was confirmed by the referendum. More than 90% of the voters supported it. But Ukraine has to fight for this independence. And again, Western assistance in that fight are absolutely essential.
I want to ask you about something else. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, who spent summers in Ukraine, said in 2014 he saw no difference between Russians and Ukrainians at all. Help us understand Ukraine's identity crisis. You mentioned the independence in 1991, but how it's influencing the current conflict.
The arguments like that, which are made not by Putin, but also by some leaders of the opposition as well, really deny in historical terms and cultural terms right of Ukrainians to exist as a nation. Because what the arguments like that are saying is not that Russians are really Ukrainians. The argument is that there is no Ukrainians per se. Ukrainians are Russians who maybe speak a funny version of the Slavic language, maybe have a different songs and dance differently, but basically they're essentially Russian. So this is an argument that was put forward by Vladimir Putin in the article that he published this summer. And this is an ideological preparation and justification for the possible invasion.
U.S.-Russia relations have been tense ever since Biden took office. What does the situation, from your perspective, tell us about the state of that relationship?
Well, the relationship are not good. This hybrid war in eastern Ukraine really changed the situation and changed attitude toward Russia in the West in general, not only in the United States per se. And we have this, the situation is not improving, but becoming worse since 2014.
Serhii Plokhii is a professor of Ukrainian history at Harvard University. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
The work from home thing remains a thing 2 years into this pandemic. So many of us have relocated to places that are cheaper to live. But do worker salaries adjust downward as well? Let's talk about this with business reporter Mark Stewart. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Scott. Always nice to be here.
Okay, say I've worked for years in New York City, and then I do this COVID move to a place like Alabama. Cost of living is much cheaper. In general, what happens to my salary? What's happening in the marketplace now?
I mean, this is the question, Scott, confronting employers and companies across the country right now. And the answer at this moment really does vary from employer to employer. Mm. I've reached out to some companies to get a look at the landscape. Google, for example, notes its compensation policies have always been determined by location. But then on the other hand, you have a company like Zillow. And moving forward, Zillow will allow most employees to work from anywhere within the U.S. and Canada. They can voluntarily relocate without having their pay reduced. You know, as one recruiter told me, this is a complex question because it can depend on where you live, your company, what your role is, and lawyers may have to get involved about where you pay your taxes, for example. So this is not a simple question. This is something that is plaguing corporate America right now.
This depends situation is happening in this broader environment where the American worker has a lot of leverage right now, right? We're in the middle of this great resignation. We almost don't have enough people working or looking for work. So if a company wants to cut my salary, will that backfire? I mean, I, the employee, I can leave, I can find another job.
Absolutely. And if you look at this issue, retention is really another lofty challenge that is facing companies right now, because as we have seen during the pandemic, replacing someone, it takes time, it takes money, and that collective cost, it's great. One recruiter said to me, you almost have to re-recruit the employees that you have. And this is not about pay raises. This is about mentorship, personal development, taking classes, tuition reimbursement, because if you have someone who is enjoying work at the company, you want to keep things that way. You want to retain that person. But with so much moving these days, it's very difficult.
Mark, does this, I guess, tell us something bigger about how the workplace is shifting?
It is shifting. And there is this idea of purpose that's being discussed. Is everyone in a company part of a bigger mission? It doesn't matter what you do, no matter your department, whether you are white collar or blue collar. This is very important to younger workers. And I talked about this with Sudal Neely. She's a professor at Harvard Business School.
And shame on us if, as organizations, as employers, we don't recognize that we have hit a pivotal moment. And those of us who get it will get the best talent, will retain the best talent, diverse in all the ways that we value.
Bottom line, Scott, things like free food that have been embraced by tech companies in the past, it just doesn't cut it anymore.
Yeah, and maybe not foosball either. Mark Stewart is a business reporter based in expensive New York. Mark, thank you very much.
Scott, be well.
A date which will live in infamy. The words of FDR still echo today as we mark 80 years since the attack on Pearl Harbor. Japan's surprise bombing, just before 8 o'clock in the morning on December 7, 1941, prompted the U.S. to rush into World War II. That attack killed more than 2,400 people.
The once mighty Arizona now rests on Pearl Harbor's muddy bottom, a pitiful relic of its former self, a grim monument to the treachery of Japan.
And now the National World War II Museum in New Orleans has a new special exhibit. It's called Infamy, Pearl Harbor Remembered. Tom Chikansky is senior curator, and he joins us. Tom, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be with you.
Now, your museum asks people, explicitly or implicitly, to ponder their own connections to Pearl Harbor. It turns out your father was in the barracks there that day. How does this personalize this project for you?
Well, having my father at Schofield Barracks, Territory Hawaii, and then he continued to serve throughout World War II, along with my uncle and an aunt, provides a very tangible connection for me. As I work on things here at the museum, it makes it very easy to want to do the best job possible for all those Americans who served in the war.
Now, Tom, your museum already covers the attack, but this new exhibit explores how it was remembered at the time and now. So in late 1941 and early 1942, how was this attack framed in the public imagination?
This attack really united the country in its efforts to join the war and in the country's resolve to win the war. And remember, Pearl Harbor became the slogan and watchword from recruiting to fundraising, and that slogan appeared on jewelry and on posters and in songs. Just throughout the war effort, it gave people a nice, tangible reason of why we needed to be at war.
Your timing is perfect. We have a couple songs queued up with the Remember Pearl Harbor phrase in it. Let's listen to a couple. The first one is by Sammy Kay.
We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Okay, and here is one more from Carson Robeson.
A job we can do, you and me. Eating, flying high, clear across the pond. Make our dollars fight, buy another bond. Remember Pearl Harbor, day and night, pray and fight, carry on.
Well, buy another bond. I mean, as you're describing, these patriotic, these propaganda songs galvanized the American public. But before the attack, were Americans politically all over the map as to whether to join the Allies or perhaps to join the Axis side?
They were. Americans were deeply divided. I would say the majority of Americans wanted to stay neutral. They felt we had no business getting involved in another foreign war, as most people saw it. There were a small number of people who thought that maybe we should be on the Axis side. And there were people who wanted to more fully support the Allies, and there were people who saw what the Japanese were doing in China and were greatly opposed to that actions. But no one agreed. And after Pearl Harbor, when Roosevelt made his famous Day of Infamy speech and asked Congress to declare war on Japan, there was only one congresswoman who voted no. Otherwise, it was a unanimous vote, which is just an amazing thing to me that everyone said, yes, we will declare war on Japan.
Now, from a public messaging perspective, are there trade-offs to this notion of rallying? I mean, I looked at the lyrics to the Carson Robeson song, and some of the words are what we today would call racist, dehumanizing depictions of the Japanese. And we know that soon after that, FDR authorizes the internment of Japanese Americans.
Certainly, the times were different, and many of the lyrics of that song are difficult to listen to today, given our current understanding. You know, I think if nothing else, the hate that was felt for the Japanese after Pearl Harbor contributed to the intensity of the war with Japan.
Your exhibit also profiles some individuals from that day. Can you tell me the story about the Hawaiian shipyard worker?
This is a man named Juan de Castro. He was a Hawaiian. And he was at work that Sunday morning at the shipyard in Pearl Harbor, And when he saw the Oklahoma roll over, he knew that there'd be men trapped, and he knew he could do something about it. So he organized other workers from the shipyard, and they went over to the Oklahoma with chipping hammers. And they used these to chisel through the steel of the ship. And it was a slow process and very tiring, but they kept after it. And by 2:30 in the morning on December 9th, they had rescued the last person they could get to. And in all, they pulled 32 men out of the Oklahoma.
Now, history with time allows us to take a fresh new look at an event like this. What do you want visitors to ask themselves as they take in this new exhibit?
I think it's important for visitors to look at the idea that Pearl Harbor was something that united this country, and it was something that had Congress act in the best interest of the country. And I think it's important for us to remember that we need to be able to consider all sides of a matter and work towards what is best for this country.
Tom Chikansky is senior curator of a new special exhibit at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. It's called Infamy, Pearl Harbor Remembered. Tom, thanks for the time.
It's been my pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Inflation is rising. But it does not affect everyone equally, and economists say rising costs can have an outsized impact on low-income people. One thing is working in their favor, though. As NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports, wages at the low end of the scale are going up, too.
The Consumer Price Index has risen more than 6% over the last year. Low-income families tend to spend a higher share of their income on gas, for instance, than higher-income households. But even if that weren't the case,
it's still going to cause a lot more stress for lower-income families because they just have so many fewer margins of adjustment to absorb that.
That's Josh Bivens, director of research at the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute. He says rising prices in certain categories are more likely to affect low-income people, like food at home rather than restaurants.
And then the really big one is rent. I mean, rent is the one that takes up a far larger percentage of total spending for low-income families than everyone else. It is the ultimate necessity.
Rents are expected to rise 10% in the next year, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Republicans have been pointing the finger at the Biden administration for rising prices and argue that the president's Build Back Better bill will exacerbate inflation. But Aaron Dubay, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, says it's important to look at what's been happening to wages and inflation over the last 2 years, since just before the pandemic.
Workers at the bottom have come out ahead in that longer span.
Over that period, inflation has risen 7%, he says, while wages in the bottom quarter of the pay scale have risen 10%. The time span changes the numbers significantly, because inflation rose very little at the start of the pandemic. And in recent months, there's been especially high wage growth at the bottom. A very unusual situation, Dubay says.
For the last 40 years, wage growth has been particularly anemic at the bottom or the middle versus much higher at the top.
But these figures are, of course, averages, and not everyone's wages are rising. Brian Springer is 38 and a veteran of the U.S. Army. He works full-time for a small company that repairs laptops and devices in Stillwater, Oklahoma.
So my company, they don't believe in pay raises. I've been here for 3 years, and I'm still making the same $10 an hour from when I started.
Springer qualifies for disability from the VA, which gives him an additional $1,700 a month. He tries to set the VA check aside for retirement and savings, but says that's hard to do.
Because inflation eats away at my salary, it goes less and less every month.
And the younger generation is particularly worried about housing costs. Maria Gomez is 19 and a college student here in Washington, D.C. She makes $17 an hour as the manager at a Mexican restaurant, about $2 more than D.C.'s minimum wage. Some of her pay goes to help with the rent on the two-bedroom apartment she shares with her parents. She would love to get her own place, but with the city's high housing costs, it feels like that'll be impossible by the time she graduates.
I know that when I get out, like when I finish my studies, I would want to live by myself, but I think it's going to become incredibly hard by probably the time that I do graduate. Stuff is going to definitely increase in price, and that kind of worries me a lot.
And Dubé, the economist at UMass, says she might be right to worry.
Housing price increases or rent increases tend to get baked in more, and once they rise, they don't reverse themselves very fast, unlike, say, gas prices or food prices.
Dubé says it's hard to make broad predictions of the future, but if rents start rising high and stay high, it could make for a longer, more uncomfortable period of inflation. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
A Trump favorite has upended Georgia's race for governor. David Perdue announced yesterday he would contest incumbent Brian Kemp for the Republican nomination. Let's listen.
Look, I like Brian. This isn't personal. It's simple. He has failed all of us and cannot win in November.
Meanwhile, Democrat Stacey Abrams is taking another shot at the seat, too, making Georgia one of the major states to watch in the 2022 midterms. For more, we're joined by WABE Politics reporter Raul Bally. Welcome, Raul.
Hello.
Well, David Perdue lost his Senate seat to Democrat John Ossoff last year. Now he's back as a primary challenger for governor, and he's gotten former President Trump's endorsement. How do Republicans you've spoken to feel about this?
I've heard a lot of frustration. I've heard loud sighs, but mainly worry. First, Republicans I talked to are concerned about next November after a possibly divisive primary. Can they get all of their voters back to the polls in a general election? And then here's the possible fallout on the local level. A Republican state lawmaker I talked to is worried what it means for his election. After redistricting, his seat is 55% Republican. If enough Republicans don't show up in November, is he in trouble? And then a different Republican state lawmaker I talked to, who's supporting Governor Kemp, is worried if he's going to be challenged by a Trump-style candidate. So a lot of questions about the fallout from a possibly divided Republican Party in Georgia.
Okay, former President Trump has a grudge against Brian Kemp for refusing to invalidate Biden's win in the state. Now Trump has endorsed David Perdue. Is the Kemp campaign worried about losing the Republican base?
They're not saying that out loud, but Republicans know that they have got to be able to reunite the party along all their fault lines. Look, here in Georgia, it was always about, for years, balancing business conservatives and social conservatives. Well, it's now those forces plus Trump supporters, along with those who don't like the former president. Now, last week, before Perdue entered the race, I asked Governor Kemp about the possibility of Perdue entering the race, what it would mean for his campaign, and this is what he had to say to me.
Trump supporters and Kemp supporters and Georgia Republicans and Georgia voters know what my record is. It is a record that I told them I would do when I was running for governor in 2018. And that is what I'm going to remind people of. And I believe when they understand that I will be reelected.
And look, former President Donald Trump has made this intensely personal. I expect to see the former president here in Georgia for David Perdue and to attack Brian Kemp.
Brian Kemp, though, still has a state to govern. How will this challenge impact the sorts of policies he'll push in the coming legislative session?
So our session here in Georgia gets started next month. And Republicans in the Georgia legislature, they were going to push conservative-leaning issues in an election year anyway. But what a Democratic lawmaker told me was that this Republican primary means that any issues that Democrats could have worked with Republicans or with the governor is likely in trouble or just likely dead.
Before I let you go, we have to talk about the other side of the aisle. Stacey Abrams is back. Republicans are already campaigning as if she is the candidate. What are Democrats telling you about the race?
Well, first and foremost, they're going to focus on fundraising. So while this Republican race is going to probably be expensive, they expect that those coffers will be refilled and it's going to be a big race. They're also going to focus on honing in their message, because the focus is really going to be on that Republican race. They're going to have time to hone their message as Democrats. I think the one thing that Democrats and Democratic operatives are trying to figure out is how involved do they get in the race? The question I was asking is, do you throw dynamite sticks into the Republican race, or you just kind of do hands off? And I think that's what they're trying to figure out as Democrats.
There's so much to watch as well. Other high-profile races, including Democrat Raphael Warnock fighting to keep his seat in the Senate. WABE's politics reporter Raul Bally, thank you so much for your time.
It was great to be on.
New York City is on the cusp of a sweeping vaccine mandate for workers in private companies. By December 27th, all employees working on site have to have their shots. Here's Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Vaccination is the central weapon in this war against COVID. It's the one thing that has worked every single time across the board.
Now, de Blasio calls this mandate a preemptive strike as case numbers rise quickly in New York City. Let's talk now to Erin Durkin. She's a reporter for Politico New York. Erin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, this mandate is going to impact more than 180,000 businesses in New York City. How is the mandate going to work in practice?
Yeah, you know, a lot of those details still have to be worked out. The mayor said that on December 15th, he's going to issue more detailed guidelines. Essentially, businesses that don't comply will be subject to fines or penalties in some respects. They may have warnings first, but it appears that the onus is, you know, really going to be on the business to get the proof of vaccination from each of its employees and, you know, just as importantly, to figure out what they're going to do with the employees who decline or do not get vaccinated.
Now, this mandate is set to take effect just a few days before Mayor Bill de Blasio leaves office and Eric Adams takes his chair. Will Adams keep this mandate?
You know, that's the million-dollar question. And he said yesterday, sort of a very vague statement of, you know, he'll review it, he'll evaluate it, he'll make determinations based on science. He appeared with the mayor last week and said, you know, oh, we're totally on the same page on all of this vaccine stuff. But he's been very reluctant to engage in specifics. You know, he's been very reluctant to say, for instance, if he's going to keep city workers who have defied the vaccine mandate on unpaid leave as they are right now. So there's still a lot of question marks about how he's going to handle this.
Wow. So from the perspective of businesses, small businesses, large businesses, we know they hate these moving goalposts. Many bosses I've read have said they've been blindsided by this. So what are the biggest risks to them? I can imagine some workers are going to say, you know what, I'm just going to quit.
Right. You know, I think we've heard a number of complaints from business leaders. One, that they were blindsided by this. It came out of nowhere. Two, the fact that, yeah, this is, you know, 4 or 5 days before a new mayor, and that this causes a lot of confusion because they're going to have one set of policies for, you know, a few days, and then it might be the same or it might be different, and they just don't know. And they've also said, you know, there's already a labor shortage, and so if they either have to fire people, have to put people on leave, or people just quit, that is going to hurt their bottom line.
Yeah, and have you been in touch with business owners directly? I mean, is that what you hear from them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, not everyone. There was, for instance, a business, a barbershop owner from the Bronx who spoke with the mayor yesterday who said, you know, he's already requiring this for his employees. And he thinks, you know, it's necessary to keep everyone safe. The customers feel more comfortable with it. And there are other employers. A survey found just under half of office-based employers have chosen on their own to impose a vaccine requirement. So there's definitely support for it out there, you know, and in the restaurant and entertainment sector, it's already been required for employees as well as patrons, and most of them have made it work one way or another.
Well, this comes in the context of New York City, like a lot of places in the country, seeing COVID cases rising, winter is coming. And I imagine there's also legal uncertainty as well. I mean, could this whole thing get challenged in court?
It could, and I'm quite sure that it will be challenged in court. You know, the question is, will it hold up? So far, all of the vaccine mandates that the city has done have held up, both for city workers, public employees, as well as for the restaurants and entertainment venues. The city is pretty confident that it will succeed and that it will withstand any challenge
Aaron Durkin is a reporter for Politico New York. Aaron, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
The Biden administration has said recently that it's considering new protections for the greater sage grouse. These are birds found in the western part of the country, known for their spectacular courtship dances. Sagebrush habitats are in peril from fires, mining, and oil and gas drilling. But as H2O Radio's Franny Halperin reports, the greater sage grouse is getting some help from unexpected allies, incarcerated men and women.
On a windy day, Gina Klingerman and I are walking across a snow-dusted hillside in southern Wyoming.
I mean, this is a national treasure that people don't realize is here.
Klingerman is an archaeologist for the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM. She says this landscape is called Sagebrush Steppe, and it's where a wildland fire scorched 14,000 acres last year.
These were probably 150-year-old sagebrush, dead, gone, forever.
Current estimates are that nearly half of sagebrush habitat is gone because of human activities, and increasingly from fires, like at this charred site about 100 miles north of the Colorado-Wyoming border.
It is at risk. It is being destroyed piece by piece. You know, oh, we're going to bulldoze this for a little road into this place, or, oh, we have another oil and gas well here, that's 5 acres there, or, you know, we have this little mining claim, that's 2 acres here. Well, that starts to add up over time.
That's a devastating loss for pronghorn, elk, and other wildlife, including the greater sage grouse, a quirky chicken-sized bird whose populations have declined by 80% in the past 50 years. The sage grouse relies on sagebrush for food and shelter, so the BLM has been trying to restore their habitats. Klingerman says just scattering seeds on the ground doesn't work to establish the plants, so they've been trying something else. She shows me little yellow cages about a foot tall, protecting hand-planted seedlings. It's arduous and time-consuming work, but they got help from a surprising source.
My name is Levi George, and I am at the Wyoming State Honor Farm.
The Wyoming Honor Farm is a minimum security prison in Riverton, Wyoming, a couple of hours north of here. Through a program called the Sagebrush in Prisons Project, inmates like Levi are helping the BLM by raising sagebrush from seed.
Yeah, we start from the beginning. We mix the dirt and the soil, make sure the pH levels are where they need to be. And then we do the seedlings. And then throughout the year, we water and fertilize them. It was very therapeutic. And it's nice to see something grow from nothing. So being able to nurture them and watch them grow, to me, it was very soothing.
The plants the inmates grew in 6 months that are going into the burn area are now about 3 inches tall. If they had been grown from seeds in the wild, it would have taken 5 years to get to the same height. The idea is to give sagebrush restoration a jump start and offer inmates a fresh start.
And at the end of the program, we give every participant a certificate. It talks about the skills that they've acquired.
That's Stacy Moore with the Institute for Applied Ecology. The nonprofit created the Sagebrush in Prisons program in partnership with the BLM and now work in 11 prisons, including ones in Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, and California.
We feel it's enriching the inmates' lives, that we're giving them education skills, horticulture skills, certificates, helping them with pro-social behaviors. And we find more inmates are wanting to do the program than there are openings.
The experience convinced Levi, who was recently released to a halfway house, to apply to work for the BLM.
I plan on still continuing to work with them and try to help other people that's been in my situation when they get out to have somewhere to start from, because it's hard for felons to get, you know, employment sometimes.
With the Sagebrush Project, prisons are reporting less violence, and studies show programs like these are reducing recidivism. Inmates say giving back to the community means a lot.
It's just knowing that you had a part of something that you're giving life to that's going to hopefully sustain other life forms it's a big deal.
It's certainly a big deal for the greater sage grouse that might see their numbers grow here thanks to the inmates who themselves are planting seeds for their own future. For Here and Now, I'm Franny Halperin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Tanya Mosley in Los Angeles. This is Here and Now.